Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. I'm back and checking up on all of Mike's wonderful shows that he did while I was gone.
They were wonderful, weren't they? Humility has never been a big part of my life here because we're looking at the camera now. Forget our crack tech person.
Are we on the air?
We've sort of been pretending. We're not live on Facebook this whole time. We've been pretending because all I can do is get the stare at my balls.
Some of the things you said about people, I'm shocked.
Most of them were about you, though. Yeah. The nastiest were about you because you were gone. Traveling the barge to Luxembourg.
Yeah.
And now you're back.
Well, spent 20 days in Europe and not speaking French or German, we had limited contact with being able to talk to people about politics. But my God, the explanation of the German welfare system and the amount of stuff, free college tuition all the way through grad school, medical care that pays for everything. So you have to pay a fee into medical care, which is about a third what you'd pay in the U.S. If you're a public employee. And they pay for everything. It's all done. If you have a kid, they give you, it would be equivalent to about $350 a month until the child is 26 years old.
Just to help out.
It helps young families. It's a really great idea to help young families.
That's an excellent
idea. And help them to help the kids through college.
So you got all these happy people over there in Europe. And we've been lied to for, what, maybe 100 years now? We've been lied to, Steve. That's why we started this show.
It's a pretty good system. They have all the problems. I mean, they're very vulnerable to the Trumpster attacks in Germany because they're a manufacturing company. They make things. Yes, manufacturing country. They make things. That's what they do. And they export things. And so they're much more vulnerable. So it is true that Trump is right about the vulnerability of other countries to the U.S. because we don't get as much of our economy from export. So he is right about all these things technically, and he's, of course, going about it all wrong. Unlike when we went to Ireland where people talked to us about Trump, we really didn't have any long discussion.
But, Steve, there's one fact there. We actually export a lot, but as a percentage, it may be less than Germany.
That's correct.
But we are a huge exporting nation.
Yes, but it's a lot less than Germany as a percentage of GDP.
Yes.
So if you want to beat somebody up, we've got leverage that they don't have. So, you know, you could have quietly negotiated some better deals and stuff because after World War II, the United States decided that it didn't need super economic deals with all these countries. It needed, frankly, power and control and influence. And so it cut deals that were in their favor in order to maintain its influence. Now, 50 years later, you know, it is time to kind of rethink that a little bit. But to harm these countries that have been long time allies of the United States, to try to harm France and Germany and Denmark, it's an amazing thing. We have Steve Signer here.
We paint these other countries as a little bit evil because they have special deals but you have to understand America has exported grains. About 60% of what we produce in America, we don't need. We overproduce grains, and what do we do with it? We subsidize it. We ship it overseas. We distort overseas markets with it. So we play the same game, but instead of doing it with cars, we're doing it with grains. So I think everybody has to stop pointing fingers. And like you say, I think we have to sit down through channels, have discussions, and then adjust these things.
The other thing I was thinking, having gone to three different countries on this particular vacation, is I think that Paul Krugman was right about the vulnerabilities of the euro. But people there love the euro because you can go from Germany to Luxembourg to France to Germany and use the same currency. It is really convenient. It would be like if we had the United States and Eastern United States, the size, those size countries like New Jersey, and every time you went to a different state. Now, originally, when the United States was formed, the states had their own currency, and it was this huge mess that when you get to the line between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, you have to change your money. You know, Euro abolishes all that. So there are social reasons why it is so popular. And people did tell us that they really liked it because they liked not having to go through this ordeal of constantly changing currency and stuff. So the con, it seems to me, in the impression I went, was we were just in France, Luxembourg, and Germany. I mean, 3,000 American soldiers, they have a big military American cemetery in Luxembourg. There's 3,000 Americans died in Luxembourg. The Germans drafted Luxembourgians because they decided that was part of Germany and sent them off to the Eastern Front where they didn't come back.
Those 3,000 Americans died fighting fascism.
That's correct.
What the kind of government we have today in the USA, where business controls government and government doesn't take care of people. That's the government we have today. It's called fascism, except nobody in the press, except maybe Steve Segner, who's not in the press, will call it what it is. It's fascism, ladies and gentlemen. It's fascism.
And in France, they have, you know, Dwight Eisenhower Boulevard and all these different names from Wilson, from President Wilson, all the way up through World War II. They have named stuff after the various liberators
well,
and stuff.
Well, after World War II, you know, Germany and Japan, manufacturing was wiped out.
Yeah.
So they had to start from scratch. So America had a 15, 20-year lead where we could make anything at any price. And a lot of it was crap, and we could sell it anywhere. And then Japan decided they were going to start building cars and learning how to do it. And Germany came along, and they bought all new equipment. They trained their people correctly, and they started making better and better products. And then they came into the marketplace, and they started people started choosing better products.
Right.
And so what happened is we say, well, how are we going to stop this? And so we started putting little roadblocks in front of them. I think it's been a long time since World War II when America yeah. was the protector of the world. I think at some point in time we have to realize, is that our job? When do we start backing down? Why do we have troops scattered through these little countries in Europe?
Why do we have a military budget that's
not crazy?
The 19 next countries combined.
Yeah, it's crazy.
If we didn't have our military budget the way it is, we could put everybody through school. We could pay for health care. We could actually build bridges. So what happens is since we're the policemen of the world, these other countries are able to concentrate on social issues.
Policeman makes it sound real nice, okay?
Yeah. The other thing is
Are we a warrior race?
Yes.
Are we warriors?
Yes.
We're never at peace. We're constantly at war. So it's not just being policemen of the world. That makes it sound benevolent
and
nice.
And people, they use the word respect. People don't respect American authority. Well, that's not respect. That's fear.
They're pushing for a war with Iran now, and they're claiming that we have to go to defend Saudi oil fields. Really?
Haven't we been selling Saudi billions of dollars worth of defense mechanisms and guns? And so why are we going there?
The one thing I would say about Europe, just going back to it for a second, is the German cities have all been rebuilt. They were utterly destroyed. They very meticulously built some of their famous buildings exactly like they were. But the German cities were utterly devastated. Frankfurt was just basically leveled. Some of the other little towns and stuff, we were just leveled. If you were near a railroad track with a bunch of Nazi tanks coming through it, your town was gone. Mm-hmm. And these towns had been around for hundreds of years. And so when you're there, you think, gosh, the Germans has this absolutely beautiful country with this wonderful literature and all this great stuff, and they started a war. And they got, 5 million Germans killed? They murdered 6 million Jews, 4 million gypsies, hundreds of thousands of other people, and 20 million Russians.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful country. You think, why would you do that? You know, I'm talking about just sort of visceral thing. Like, why would you get these beautiful cities leveled? Because when you go into Strasbourg, this town is intact. And it's because it got skipped by World War II.
Well, you know, it goes back to World War I. World War I came to a stalemate. Both sides were pretty much stuck. America came in and pushed the balance. And the Germans always felt that, you know, they were cheated. If we'd have stayed out of World War One, what would have happened? They would have come to an agreement. They would have been armistice. They would have stopped fighting, and we wouldn't be in the situation we are today. But we took a proactive and went to Europe. We didn't need to go to Europe. Okay.
Yeah.
So from that, what happened after 1917? Germany was put under tremendous pressure for war reparations, and they could never ever kind of get above it. So what happened? A resentment built up against the French and the English, but primarily the French. The French have always been worried about the Germans. The French have always been worried about the Germans because the Germans had lots of kids, and the French didn't.
There's an incredible memorial up in the Vosges Mountains to both German and French fighters, soldiers during World War One. The trenches are a dozen or 2 yards apart.
Yeah.
They still exist. The German and French trenches still exist. 17,000 people on the top of this damn mountain.
Wow.
17. Yeah. When you go to a little village like where some of my ancestors are from, there are all these memorials. So in this little tiny, tiny town that the Pingenos are from, the Pingenos who stayed, there's two of them that were killed in the war. In World War One,
wow.
In this little town, there's 16 names of young men who died in World War One.
Yeah,
yeah. So this didn't happen in World War Two because the French surrendered and they didn't have a lot of casualties. Mm-hmm. But in World War One, you can feel it, Mike. You can feel the amount of losses that you can imagine. Think of a little village of a couple of thousand people and you lose 16 young men.
Well, it was a human slaughter, and then we do build memorials, and we do. It's impactful stuff when you have, as in World War One, human slaughter. Not that we didn't have plenty of slaughter in World War Two, but the things we're talking about so far this morning are national things, are federal things. Mm-hmm. We're talking about things nations deal with on a quote unquote federal level, and what we want to get to, we want to segue, because that's what Steve Segner is doing on the show this morning. Besides his wonderful history knowledge, we want to talk about local stuff. We want to talk about things that that we deal with every day, and it's what we deal with every day is trying to find a place to live and a place we can afford. I entered Sedona at the service level in 1972. I came in. I pulled a lot of weeds. I won't tell you my biography, but I pulled a lot of weeds and I poured a lot of coffee. And I laid a lot of bricks, believe it or not, on my way to a couple of degrees from NAU. But the point is, I there was places to live in a variety. I had choices. I had so many choices. We don't have those choices today, do we?
No, the state government took them away from us. We had a nice mixed population here. We had low-income kind of trailer homes that we could rent for $600-$800 a month. You had back rooms that people could rent. You had little casitas that weren't being used. And this kind of housed a lot of our service industry. And then when the 1350 got passed and the unintended consequences is that everybody could rent those spaces out on a nightly basis, it displaced about 700 people. Well, that's a lot of people. They started moving to the edge of town. They were living in trailers. They are still living in the trailers on some dirt roads. It forced a lot of people back to Cottonwood. So, yes, we're hurting. But what it really did, too, is it took away a social mix. We lost these 30- and 40-year-olds. We lost people with kids.
Right.
And so we're turning into a Sun City North.
Right.
Where it's all about, I came here to retire, and this is my retirement dream. And it just seems to me that's what I'm hearing more and more. It's like, why should this city be run for your dream? I came here to dream to open up a business and hire employees.
Yeah,
and
15 years ago, even, Steve, when I first came here, I noticed there was some tension between the retirees and what mm-hmm. they wanted and what people who were working like me and my wife, we were working and we had, you know, a little bit different things we wanted than the people who retired. And now I think you're right. It's moved more and more to just being a retirement. my question, and to Mike too, maybe has some ideas, is what the hell can be done about it? I don't see how you stop this process.
Well, you know, what we need to do is we need to build workplace housing. We need to have apartment buildings. You go to Scottsdale right now, they're building thousands of apartments. The idea that young kids are buying them, we think the older people, we got to buy homes. Well, the homes we build here are expensive, and they're big, and they're on big lots, and they're for people who have already made a little money. But we don't have any starter housing.
Right.
And starter housing is, like in Germany or in Europe, it's going to have to be driven from the social level of local government. You can't expect a developer to come in and say, I'm going to put in some low-income housing for you. And we're not talking low-income. I'm talking $600, $800, $1,000, $1,200 a month. Units.
Yeah.
They
live in much smaller housing in Europe than we do. Middle class housing is what we would consider, a thousand square feet or something.
My hobby is the arts and craft movement and housing, believe it or not, of the turn of the century. And when housing first came along and a middle class developed around 1910, people said, well, what's a house? And so the arts and craft movement come up with these houses you could buy from Sears, Roebuck, and Montgomery Ward. And they were kit houses. And they were 800 square feet to 1,100 square feet. You'd order it. You'd put it on your lot, and you'd build it. And in these communities in Pasadena, San Diego, back in New York, they're amazing little houses. You go back to Burbank, where I came from, the average house was 1,100 square feet, had three kids.
Wow.
So we've got this distorted idea of what a house has to be.
Yeah.
Now down in Scottsdale, they're building two bedrooms, 900 square foot places. They're renting for $3,000 a month. So we need to relook at how things are done. The city has a housing unit. I'm on their committee. I'm looking at it. They're looking at it. They're going to do some studies. They've got some money in the bank. They have some will, and I think we have a city council who this is an important thing for. My job, I think, is a little bit is to kind of kick them in the butt.
There you go. Well, as a businessman, you can do that, and you do head an association. But the idea is that we do this everywhere, even in the United States. If you go to the Grand, if they want a worker, they provide housing. If you go to the Grand Canyon, you get some deal on housing. I remember when you went to Lake Powell, once again, back in my day, I went to Lake Powell. I was provided housing, both as that's at the service level, if I was cleaning houseboats, and at the teacher level, by the way. There was housing because they wanted you to work there. If you went to Baghdad, the mining company paid for housing. Mm-hmm. If you went to work on the Salt River Project's plant, they paid for housing. If you went and built a bridge somewhere in northern Arizona, they paid for housing, or at least subsidized it. Why can't the city of Sedona subsidize, find a way to get some housing?
Well, I think it's doable. I think the city owns some land. The city has, I think, about $3 million in the fund. I think there are systems, and I think the city knows that.
What are they afraid of, Steve?
I don't think they're afraid. I think they want to make the step right. And so I think, in a way, I'm frustrated that they're going slow, but I also understand that they really need to get the people behind them. Because Sedona, this town can blow up over a light,
indeed.
Or a stop sign. So I think what they're going to do, and I think it probably does make some sense, they're paying for a study about housing, and then they can come back from this housing and point at it. Now, everybody criticized when they paid $250,000 for the road study. I remember I helped chip in on that. We chipped in $10,000.
Sure.
$250,000, and everybody says, another study. And then our city council says, no, we took the study, and they started Sedona in Motion. So all this that's happening now started with a study, and that's what cities kind of have to do. So I think the study is going to be started. I think we're putting some money aside. We've identified property around the city.
You've identified property.
We've identified property that the city owns or could be bought that I think could be used. So I think then if we get some professionals to guide us, the thing I'm fighting a little bit is I'm not looking for a third party to do this. I want the city to do it. I think the city should build and own. And I went to a meeting the other day, and I got the big stop motion, and I said, well, wait a minute. If we own the property, we can help with the plumbing, we can help with the building a little bit, and we own the buildings. And they said, well, we don't want to manage them. I said, we turn it over to a management company. And so the criteria I put forward was, is it one, you're a teacher, fireman, policeman, city employee, and then a worker in Sedona. Those are the five categories you would use to get this housing. It's not subsidized housing. It's just if we can get the cost out of building, and we don't need to make a margin of profit like a capitalist would, we're going to say this is a service. So what happens, we can have a nice little place for $600 to $800 a month. We're going to have teachers who'll stay.
I have absolutely no faith in a third party running housing in Sedona or anywhere else that isn't going to rape the tenants.
I totally agree. I talked to three companies who do student housing
financially,
and they go to Santa Barbara, they went up to California, they build student housing, and they basically get the land for $1 a year, which takes 30% of the cost out. And they all three told me, do not let a third party own your buildings. And so they said, Steve, we know the game. It's every year coming back. Oh, this happened, that happened. And they work whatever they can do to get it up to market rates. That's the game they play. So I think we have to get away from this idea. If the city can buy a city hall building, they don't expect a return on the investment of the city hall. The city hall is there for a function. Why can't we have housing that's there for a function for teachers, firemen, policemen, and local workers?
Any third party will use government money to get started, and as you just said, within the shortest time possible, they will get quote-unquote to market rates, completely subverting the whole idea of workforce housing. We don't want to call it fascism. This is where business is telling government what to do, and they're so afraid. So you have a government, so you got to get along with these guys. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily. You got a government that's afraid of business because they don't want to be seen as competition, because they don't want to be seen as providing workforce housing for everyone, and by having low income housing, that they would somehow be in competition, even though they know that they could never come up with enough regulations to force some
I think in Sedona out. Though the business community, and Steve is kind of a representative, is less the problem than the againers, Mike. These ideological.
My
dad used to call the people who are against everybody in Oklahoma, a small town in Oklahoma. My dad, there were people who, my dad used to joke, he said, the beginners start out with 49%, and we start out with 1%, and we have to get to 51%. You know, that's what my dad said, and they're beginners. And Sedona is characterized by these people who freak out, and I guess there's no better term for it, and get hysterical about any change in Sedona. And so part of it is ideological. I just don't believe government should do anything for anybody, Mike.
I see.
Yeah.
All right.
The New York Times had an article a few weeks ago. They talked about the problem with affluent cities is all the same. When you become affluent, you don't want people coming that aren't like you. In other words, they expect people to buy their way into these expensive towns like Scottsdale and Beverly Hills and Sedona. And it's... In a poorer town, people don't care because they aren't politically connected. They don't politically put up the fight. Some of the areas that I identified by the city are right next to affluent homes. And so the first thing the city staff says, oh, we're going to get a lot of pushback. So what? Okay?
Yeah.
That's political will. And I think if it's done correctly, we can overcome those problems. But we've got to get past this idea that I've earned my way to Sedona. And there was a big blow-up last week where somebody was talking about building homes down in Camp Verde. And the people in Camp Verde went nuts saying, well, we don't want those workers from Sedona coming to Camp Verde to live in this low-income housing. So we're becoming tribal. We're becoming tribal by age. We're becoming tribal by area. We're becoming tribal by affluence. Okay, and it's showing in our national election. We are two tribes now fighting it out. We have to get past this. But whenever we try to get past tribalism, they call it socialism, which is the neighbor of communism, you know.
Look, all the socialist governments in Europe are all capitalist governments. You have private property. You have businesses being owned by people. What they have is social support for the population.
Yeah.
You know, as I was talking about, you know, if you have a kid, the government will give you some support. And they call it, in Germany, they call it a gift.
Mm-hmm.
They don't pretend that it's anything else. You have a kid, you're a young person, you need help. we give you a gift. The government gives you a gift for 26 years.
But in America, we have this, I think, this Protestant belief that you have to pull up your own bootstraps. You have to do it on your own.
It'll ruin them. It'll ruin them.
Yeah,
and we're so poor.
It'll make them
lazy. We don't have enough money to do what you... We can't do this.
Yeah.
What do you think we are? The richest country in the history of the world? Oh, wait a minute. We are the richest country in the history of the world. And yet we can't do this.
Yeah.
We got people living out here, you know, we got homeless veterans. We can't even take care of our veterans, for God's sake.
Yeah, yeah. Our system is an interesting system. I always see it like one of these ladders that are big at the bottom and small at the top. They put up against buildings.
Yeah.
And you start off with lots of people building their career, and they go up the ladder. And little by little, they get kicked off the edge, kicked off. But everybody's trying to get to the 2% at the top. Well, what do we do with those people who get kicked off the edge? What about the people who are sick? What about the people that have mental illnesses? What about the people who have car accidents? You know, do we just abandon them and let them sleep on the streets?
Or people who are just not good at whatever they're supposed to be good at.
Not,
you know, and if they were in the Middle Ages, they would probably be doing fine.
Yeah.
You know, they would be doing just what was needed. But they're just, you know, some people just don't fit in with the job categories of the modern world very well. And they're kind of... excuse me, the term, screwed from birth.
One.
Because, you know, they're not going to ever be rocket scientists.
Well,
they're not even going to be businessmen.
And that's a good point, because if our society is all going to be based on technology and math skills, but only 20% of the people are really, really good at it, what does that do to everybody else? So I think we have to make a place for everybody a little bit, and I think we all have to give back a little bit.
Think about it. If you were a poet in a medieval society, there's no rule for you. If you were a beginning scientist, those guys had to fight for anything. There's no path for them. And I think in our society it's much, much more complex. But I think for a lot of people there's no healthy path. But these are good people who are willing to work and contribute to the society. But their skills are just not the ones that get rewarded highly in our society. And I think that's one reason why I support kind of a sort of social democracy, because these people are contributing. Look, firemen are never going to get rich. Teachers are never going to get rich, Mike. They're never going to become entrepreneurs, most of them. I mean, they decided when they became teachers or social workers or whatever it is that they're never going to be super rich.
But teachers are poorly paid because primarily it was women's work. And you know what? We just kind of, it's a second job. It's women's work. They weren't aggressive about asking for raises. And we've taken advantage of them for year after year after year. I was so glad to see that last year they stood up and said, enough's enough. But, you know, for the amount of education that it takes to become a teacher to be paid $36,000 a year in this state is embarrassing.
Well, that's what I saw. We don't have a teacher shortage. We have a shortage of people with master's degrees that will work for $36,000
a year.
That's what we have.
I like that post of yours.
Now, the reality that I remember.
I will say, folks, that Mike posts a lot of interesting stuff on Facebook. So if you want to befriend him, don't, because you'll be inundated by a thousand good, interesting posts. And if your brain only functions part of the time, that's hard.
You lose every friend and relative you ever had,
right,
which is not so bad. But the reality of teaching, and this is an aside, I guess, at least in my experience, is that at the elementary level, 90% women. At the secondary level in the USA, because of coaching in the old days, it was a man's job.
Yeah.
80% of the high school staff I worked at, both high schools, were males because of the coaching. And now that is probably balanced out to 50-50 at least by now, and maybe once again more women.
But what can we do to help? I mean, we don't have the sort of social support. They call it a social safety net, but it's not just a safety net. I mean, when you give young couples, when they have kids, some economic support, that's not just a safety net. That's trying to boost their chances, their ability to raise their kids properly. And, of course, they have free kindergarten and free everything.
Well,
but
look at it from this point of view. You just had this scandal where rich people are buying their way into Ivy League colleges.
And also not so great colleges.
Yeah. Well, and they're
$500,000 to get in USC.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, USC.
Yeah.
graduates. You know, it's a great, it's a good college. But 500 grand.
But they're all about giving their kids a shoe up,
they
helping
are.
Them in life. But yet, when we try to do that with regular people, okay, blue collar workers,
right.
we're seen as somehow morally corrupting
commies.
Them. Yeah. So if we're if we have this society that perpetuates its own interests. But we're lacking workers now. We're lacking blue collar workers because we said blue collar work is demeaning. You should work with your brain. Okay,
yeah.
I always tell people that my failure in life is that I'm a blue collar worker at heart, but I had to use my brain to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
But I really respect the jobs of electricians and plumbers and all these jobs that make $80,000-$90,000 a year, and our kids don't know it. They all want to go to school, pay $130,000 in tuition, get a master's degree, and make $47,000 a year, and be fired at will by anybody above them.
Well, the European programs to train workers and skilled workers are incredible. It's free education. They'll send you to school for 4 or 5 years. If your skills get behind the line of where technology is moving, they'll retrain you.
But in Germany, in grammar school or in junior high, they test you and they pretty much say, you're going to college, you're going to industrial school, you're going to be this. And they put you on a path early on and help you become an apprentice. Now, an apprentice system in Germany is a 6-year program, but when you come out, you are very France is the same way. It's a 7-year program. It's more than a master's. And when you come out with a master's degree in, say, woodworking,
yeah.
they publish it in the paper. I had a customer tell me, he says, they put my picture in the paper because I went through this program. They don't care about college. They really respect the blue-collar jobs that have gone through the trade programs.
Well, the craftsman is something to be respected. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, my dad said, you never get rich working for a living.
I know what he means.
And what he meant was, the way to get rich is the secondary way. You got to use your brain.
Yeah.
And if you want to get rich. Now, we're talking about making a living. There's a big difference. You can make a fine living as a craftsman in the United States. You just can't get there. It's just extremely difficult to get there. The other enlightened societies we're talking about make it easy. While you guys are thinking, I'm going to talk about our next show. First of all, I want to talk about our last show, Jeff Bigger's show. Please go find it on Facebook. Go find it at our website, Democratic Perspective website. It was a great show, inspiring speaker about resistance and how important it is. I heard him the next day in Cottonwood, and it was just brilliant. I have to admit, I have a great deal. His parents live here in Sedona, and it was a very sweet moment while you guys were gone. Jeff Biggers turned to the camera and wished his 89-year-old dad a happy birthday. The fact that we are televised that we are on social media is a cool thing. Kim Haddow will be here next year. We're going to talk about local control. Kim Haddow is an expert at these things when it comes to the Arizona League of Cities and Towns. So we want to talk about it. I think this is a really big deal. We've talked, the show has ranged far and wide this morning, from the federal level, from the national level, and we're the states, counties, and now we want to talk local control. We're talking about municipalities and counties. We also want to make sure, I'm going to squeeze this in, about Democrats of the Red Rocks. We want to thank them for helping us be on the air. Democratic Perspective is archived. Now we've been on for 8 years, folks, and we want to hear from you. We want to hear from you through the webpage. We want to hear from you through the Facebook page. We want to find out, should we do a call-in show? Steve thinks we should do a call-in show. He thinks we think fast enough, even in our dotage here, these two old guys can think fast enough to do a call-in show. If not, we'll get Segner, but we want to do a call, and we want you guys to be able to call in and share in the kind of fun that we're having here, quite frankly. There it is. It's where we want to talk about.
Yeah, we have these really serious programs. We wouldn't want to become big dialogues. We have programs like this that Yeah, we'd love to have people call in and join the conversation, because it is a conversation about political issues. And I think particularly next week when Kim comes, it's very important. The problem we have, Steve, with you know it better than anybody else, the reason we have a problem with the Airbnbs is because of the state government taking local control away. But the state government is massively taking local control away in a lot of different ways and a lot of different issues.
Policy is very important, and policy should take time, and city moves slow. Anything that happens to Sedona takes a year and a half. Now, you get frustrated sometimes, but the idea is they don't want to do bad policy. They don't want to bring bad laws up. They want to get everybody input. And when you don't let have input, that's you get bad legislation.
So, Steve, let me ask you, what do you think Sedona needs now? I mean, what's your next move to try to improve the city? Because you've done a lot of things. Folks may not know it, but all those wonderful signs when you climb up the hill to Uptown, Steve, was Steve's idea, and Steve provided the funds for them. So you've done some innovative things for Sedona. What does the city, I guess, need to do for itself? I've been going around the new roundabout in Uptown. It works fine. I thought they built it very efficiently.
Well, I think the city's on the right track. First of all, we're a progressive city in the sense that we have more money than most cities. 80%, almost 80% now of our funds come from visitors. Now, the visitors aren't going to stop. Phoenix and the metropolitan area is growing like a weed. So we're going to have visitors, and we need to plan on it. So first of all, I think we need to say we are a tourist town. We have to say it out loud and come out of the closet. And if that's the case, you say, how do we handle the tourism and also make life palatable for the people who live here? So it's a balancing act, and I totally understand that. But I think by ignoring the idea we're a tourist town, we're just putting our head in the sand. Now, the city has lots of funds. They end up spending only about 80% of what they budget every year, and they bring in about 17% more than they budget on income. So we have money. So you go down to Scottsdale and you see nice streets. You see nice plantings. You see things that are out of the way. We're going that route. What happens? We have people who don't want us to do anything. And we've got to get past those naysayers and understand that if we have the money, it doesn't cost the locals a dime. Why don't we do the things that are important? Why don't we do more social things? You know, why don't we have a bus service? Why aren't we having services that'll take people to the trailheads? Why are they driving there? Why don't we come up with a policy that when you get to a hotel, you never need to get back in a car? That's my goal.
That's good.
Now, if that's the goal, then I have to work backwards. And how do I get people uptown? Well, you have restaurants now that pick people up. Okay? Why don't we have buses that'll take you to the different trailheads so we don't have to fill up the neighborhoods with all these cars?
Right.
So these are and I think the city knows these, and they're working towards them. So this is not a criticism of the city. They are working that direction. And I feel like we have a city council that gets it.
For those of us who were listening to KAZM earlier today, they did talk about on the duo, I believe it was, that the 27th Amendment to the Constitution, it was proposed as part of the original 10, it was the 11th, didn't make it, and it was about Congress funding itself. It only took 202 years for that little piece of government to happen. So, yes, government, and this was the point that Mike Tabak made on the show this morning, that government can work slow. And this has got to be the record, though, 202 years for a piece of legislation to actually get ratified and to become part of the constitutional law.
I think that the
hopefully Sedona will be quick faster than that.
We were, you know, of course, in Europe, and then in Strasbourg is a beautiful, beautiful city. It's a big city, a couple hundred thousand people. But when you are walking around the famous things in Strasbourg, it's mostly tourists looking at other tourists. Mm. And you see that to some extent in Sedona. The world's changing that way, and it is a long-term management problem, because mostly what you're seeing is other tourists. If you go off to some little village where your relatives eventually came from, you don't see any tourists. But on all the big, beautiful, famous things, I mean, you're mobs of tourists looking at other tourists.
Well, you know, got to remember, America in the 40s and 50s was a manufacturing and buy doodad stuff. We were fixing our homes up. We were buying chairs. We were going to Sears.
I think that people forget that, Steve, that 50s were really where
rebuilding.
People were buying stuff to fix up their houses.
Yeah.
And we may not think that a linoleum chair with metal legs was a big deal, but in those days, that was an innovation.
You had the 30s where nothing happened. Then you had World War II, and then all of a sudden the 50s came and people wanted to settle down, have houses, buy a car, and have kids. And they did that. Well, that drove our economy. Our economy now is going to be driven in the future by service industries, okay? People, the millennials are going to be in smaller places. They may or may not drive cars. They will go out to dinner. They will go to movies. The average vacation now for millennial is 3 days here, 3 days here, 3 days here, 3 days here. They don't go and sit one place for 2 weeks at the beach. So we are becoming a service-oriented economy, and Sedona is right smack in the middle, in the sweet spot of that industry. So how do we take our product? And my question has always been, if I was designing Sedona, how would I make it the most user-friendly city in America? User-friendly. In other words, everybody's happy when they leave. And, you know, do we have enough public toilets? Do we have good signing? How do we get to the trailheads easily? How do I get out to eat? How do I meet locals? That's a big question.
That is a big question.
Well, my hotel people sit around the evening and around the fireplace and they talk and they meet people from other places. That's the high point of their trip.
They talk about that. I think that's a good point, Steve.
So I think that the people who are unhappy with Sedona, they need to get out and meet all these great people who have come. This week alone, I met three professors that I could sit down and have long-term discussions with that I would never, ever have a chance to meet if they weren't visiting. I met 2 weeks ago, and I'm going back to visit him in Atlanta. He designed the Atlanta airport. He owned the largest architectural firm in Atlanta. He's a black man, and he's on the Carnegie Institute. How could I ever meet somebody like this if he didn't come to Sedona? We sit down and had coffee in the morning. So there is so much opportunity. And if you're going to sit in your little house and complain that it takes me 10 minutes on a Saturday to get the bashes, you're not going to get everything Sedona can give you.
I am available, by the way, you can buy me drinks, you can buy me meals, and I will give you all the local color you could possibly stand. Moving on.
I think the thing is that folks, as you'll see us, we talk about local issues, we talk about national issues, we've only got a couple of minutes. I think that people really have to be aware of the building crisis now in the country with the late Donald Trump's latest attempt to misuse a foreign government to fight his political enemies. We've never seen this before. It is absolutely an impeachable offense. Mike and I can argue the politics of trying to impeach him, but this is really criminal. What we're seeing now is a new level of obviousness. And so I think that people have to work on both national levels, where it's kind of unpleasant to think about things, and also local levels, Mike.
Without a doubt. If those of you that want to, I have the simple, straightforward, no frills, the 40 things that Donald Trump has done, including this latest pressuring a foreign government to spy on another...
He did it with the Russians. There's obviously collusion there. I mean, we may not have the proof that he did it, but if you step back, it's obviously all that all.